The sun is down and the deadlines are out. Welcome to Stay Out of Maine, a Stephen King podcast. I am the Critical Android, and joining me for this episode, it's the one and only Dougie Style.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening for whoever's listening at what time. But hopefully evening, it'll be the better mood to set.
Yes, and hopefully you're not listening to this as you prepare for prom, because we're talking about Carrie today, specifically the novel, Stephen King's first published full-length novel, from 1974. This is no surprise to anybody what the story is about, since it's very famously been made into a movie three times, though one of them is more famous than the others for very good reason, but that'll be another discussion for another day as we talk about the films, because today we are talking about the novel itself. As I mentioned, this is the first one that King had published, and we started off the podcast series with Salem's Lot. To go back to this, it's very interesting to see King's start as a writer, specifically with how this book is framed, but we'll get into that more in a moment here. I think you and I both had the same start off with Carrie, Doug. As I said, we both were introduced to the concept and the story because of the movie. Either with you, I know, having a love for horror. In my case, my mother was a huge horror fan, so this movie was something that I was introduced to very young. But what's your experience with the story of Carrie?
Yeah, like you said, the introduction for me came from the Brian De Palma film about 20 years ago when I was first really getting into horror movies. And I can't remember now if I saw that one first or The Shining. It was one of those two movies that I saw first for Stephen King that I actually sat through. Because as I said before, the late 90s, I was absolutely terrified of horror films, but Halloween changed all that. I won't get too much into the film since obviously we're going to talk about that next time, but yes, that was my introduction. And it's interesting too how Carrie is one of those stories, like a lot of Stephen King, that's so iconic, people don't even have to read the book or even seen the movie to know what happens in it, to know what it means when people bring up Carrie. It's a title that's become a descriptor, if you know what I mean. And it's been parodied so many times in so many different places. Like even Tiny Toons did a Carrie parody.
Well, Tiny Toons parodied a lot of things. They even threw a Citizen Kane parody in there.
But, you know, that's something that went over my head when I was younger. And then when I saw it much later in life, I realized, oh, that's Carrie. Got it. You know, I actually posted on Facebook last week. I went out for a picnic with my husband, and we were eating, and I brought Carrie to read, and someone just joked, like, oh, this is an interesting juxtaposition, a nice romantic outing with light food and Carrie. And everyone laughed because everybody knows what Carrie is. We did start with Salem's Lot, and then we wanted to do The Shining, but it felt important to go back, I think, to this book first before we continued, because it is a seminal book for many reasons. And like you said, the least of which, this is the first book Stephen King published under his name. He may have published another book, though, under Bachman, though, correct?
No, he had written books as Bachman that he wanted to put out. This is his first published novel, and then the Bachman books he wanted to publish later to see if his success was a fluke and if he could publish something else and get it popular under a different name, like what was it going to be? But I compared to, there is a Richard Bachman book called Rage, which is in some ways similar thematically. It's a book that actually King has disavowed now because it talks about a kid who, it's basically Pearl Jam's Jeremy, essentially.
And it's been out of print now for a while, too.
Right, because of King's fears of what the descriptions of violence and the influence it could have over people is. But Carrie is actually not too far removed from that principle regardless. Change the context a little bit, and Pearl Jam's Jeremy could have easily been Carrie.
Right. It's just that this has more, I think, an element of the supernatural than Rage does, correct?
Correct. Rage is straight up not supernatural at all, whereas Carrie obviously dives into that and is more tied to different themes, rather, because there's a lot that goes on here besides just the bullying aspect. And that's something that we'll get into in discussing the book. Yeah, this idea of kind of a rage-filled revenge tale being taken out upon people from a school. Again, if you change the context a little bit, this is not very far removed from the idea of a school shooting, so to say. Sadly, you know, to put it in that context. Very similar, just that in this case, we were sympathizing with the protagonist and the victim of the bullying and the psychological ramifications of it that have now manifested in a paranormal way.
And I think the paranormal aspect is a really important piece to talk about, because like you said, it's not too dissimilar to his other book, and it's not too dissimilar, sadly, to what's happened in the last 10 to 20 years with schools, with the shootings and whatnot. This is something that has become more and more of a problem that plagues our society. But because King is using the supernatural here, I think he's able to get away with certain things, as well as discuss certain things and look at certain things that maybe he couldn't otherwise, which is something that I think is a real staple of both the horror and science fiction genres, because they do have an unreality to them. In some ways, they're able to talk about reality more bluntly than a normal drama could. And I think that's exactly what King is doing here. He's using the supernatural as a way to discuss some really heavy, dark subjects about bullying, about abuse, and, you know, about revenge and anger and rage, and just a lot of different kinds of emotions that would probably be a lot more uncomfortable to read if it didn't have the supernatural element attached to it.
In the book, we find out that Carrie briefly leaves the gymnasium where the prom is being held.
And yes, then comes that was back. Interesting.
Right. It's a slightly different turn of events from what we see in the film. But in the book, Carrie briefly leaves the gym and then comes back in and terrorizes it with her telekinetic abilities. If the context was different and she left the gym, picked up an assault rifle and went back in there and shot people, would this be a completely different story than that, and a completely different protagonist that we couldn't sympathize with? Like, that one action changes the entire context of the book.
Right, even though the consequences would be mostly the same.
Especially in the light of everything that's happened today. But like you said, because the supernatural element is there, and because horror and sci-fi tend to go off in these directions of showing how those things work, we have something that we can use as a means of looking at how bullying affects people and the extents that they can go to, but without having that grim realism and a replicable act. Which I think is the other big thing. This is not a replicable act. It's not something that somebody can go out and just do. They can't go out and, you know, terrorize a gymnasium with telekinesis. That we know of.
Right.
but the point remains the same, that because this is not an act that can be replicated, it's treated differently. This also ties into the fact that there's actually, in the book, I don't want to keep saying in the book compared to the film, because the film is going to be taking another podcast.
But it's fair, because the movie is so iconic, much like The Shining movie by Stanley Kubrick. I think more people come to this story through the movie first and then the book, as opposed to maybe some other Stephen King novels. So I think it's fair game to talk about the movie a little bit, though.
Because the movie is essentially just a school bullying revenge tale with an element of what happens when you have a religious zealot as a mother. So it deals a little bit with that theme too. Carrie, the book, is doing a couple of different things. Yes, it's still a story about revenge. It's also a story about religious zealotry. But it's also a story about what happens to the world as we know it, in a way, or at least a part of the world, when supernatural events that have never transpired before on a public level have finally happened, and how the world reacts to it. And that is shown through, very similarly to how we discussed something with Dracula when we were talking about Salem's Lot, and how Dracula had a lot of diary entries and newspaper articles. That's a lot of what Carrie is that you would not know if you had just seen the film. Because much of the storytelling here is done, it's through the lens of the future, looking back at the past. The story itself, it takes place in a very near future, I should say. Because the book, as we mentioned, was written in 74. The events of the story take place in 79. So we're in a not-so-far future, but all the events of the book have already transpired, because much of the storytelling is done through essays, articles from scientific articles, and things like that, that are analyzing what has happened in this small town in Maine, and how the United States, in particular, is dealing with the discovery of telekinesis.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting too about that is, unlike The Shining and Salem's Lot even, this is a story where the horror becomes known to the world.
Yes.
And in Salem's Lot, the horror descends on the town and nobody really knows what's happening besides a few people until it's too late. And then even after that, it starts infecting other towns, but it's still pretty much nobody knows about it in the rest of the country. It remains something that it's a horror that struck, but nobody can see it. And then The Shining was even more personal, as we talked about, you know, dealing with 3.5 characters, basically, at the Overlook Hotel. And outside of those four characters, you know, nobody else really experienced what happened there and can really, you know, talk about it. Where, yes, here, what happens in this book happens on such a huge level that the rest of the world has to comment on it and has to deal with it and has to try to come to terms with the fact that there may be something that they never understood before that's now at play that could cause great damage, you know, in the future. Something that the book does, where it kind of leaves off in a mini little cliffhanger where there's another girl born who has similar powers to Carrie. So that, I think, was pretty interesting contrast between the other two books. I don't think it'll be the last time King does this, though. I think we will see some other stories that will see the supernatural impact the larger world, but I don't think he'll do it as often. So it is interesting here in his first book that he does do that. And the way the book is structured, it did take me a second, more like a minute maybe, to actually kind of acclimate to it, because it was jumping back and forth between what was technically the past with different newspaper, magazine discussions, court documents, and but this book doesn't really have clearly defined chapter breaks like his other books do. I mean, it's divided into like two parts, but other than that, just kind of paragraphs that are separated. So it did take me a minute to kind of understand, not understand, but just get what was happening, how he was telling the story. Once I did, then I felt could follow it pretty easily and found it intriguing. But it is a different, he is telling the story, I think, in a very different way than he did in Salem's Lot and The Shining on a couple different levels.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons for that is that King realizes that the basic story is too small and too brief to be able to fill a novel. Since really the events of the story, if you were to boil them down, basically would be half of this book, and that's it. So you'd have half the novel if you cut out all the extraneous framing that's done here. But fortunately, the framing is not entirely extraneous. It does put things into a different, bigger context of how this has impacted the world in a way. You know full well, as I do, from watching enough horror and sci-fi, that all too often we watch movies where terrible things have happened, huge things maybe, that would have impacted the world and had bunches of survivors and people going off and telling the story of what happened, but we never get to see, for the most part, what the world is like after those events transpire. We're just kind of, you know, left in a situation of where, okay, the story's over. But if that world kept turning, what would it be like? And that's what's happened with Carrie, in the sense that, yeah, the world did keep turning, and we're actually in that world right now looking back at what happened and how that has changed things. And it's handled in a very interesting way, though I do think that it misses an opportunity here in that later on, a lot of what they comment on in these articles is from the book The Shadow Exploded. It's a phrase you're going to hear quite a bit or read quite a bit as you're going through it. From The Shadow Exploded. And it's basically like a scholarly article that was researched about the history of Carrie, the character, why she was able to do what she did and how that came to be. But one of the later books that we see snippets from is I Am Sue Snell. And that's the story of Sue Snell, the person who befriends Carrie in a way and has her boyfriend Tommy go to the prom with her. And the book kind of shifts at some point in time to kind of painting out Sue as being this character that they want, the government wants to scapegoat, because there's a commission, the White Commission, that was formed to study what happened and find an answer to why Carrie did what she did. And Sue's being labeled as a scapegoat for all this. They're basically saying that she was the ringleader, or at least one of them, who set Carrie up to fall. And Sue's not having any of it, but instead of focusing on Sue and really fleshing that out, we only get that towards maybe the last quarter of the book. And I feel like if they really wanted to do that and effectively make it work, then they should have been focusing on Sue a lot more through the course of the events and maybe doing more of her transcriptions. We have, as the court details, the questions and answers, but we don't get that until near the end. So as much as the framing device works, I feel like there was a missed opportunity to capitalize on what King was trying to do with Sue's character.
Yeah, and something else that if you listen to the introduction by King before the book, I mean, it's obvious that he kind of struggled with this story. Originally, it was supposed to be a short story.
Yes.
What he was going for. And then he padded it out a little bit later. But he even threw it out at one point, and it was his wife that picked it out of the trash and told him she wanted to know how it ended. And so you could tell this is a story that I think King really did struggle to write. But I think once he got it, it was a big breakthrough for him. And I think that led to more confidence and probably, I don't want to say better storytelling, because this is still very good storytelling in The Shining, especially that he's really tapping into some real inner feelings and just spilling it on the page without fear of what people are going to think. And he kind of had an idea where he's going. We're here, as much as it's interesting to see the other points of view besides the present tense or the past tense, whatever the main part of the story takes place in, it does feel like he probably added a lot of that stuff later and kind of inserted it into different parts of the book. And so maybe that's why some of it doesn't feel as rich with Sue and kind of comes too late, because he wasn't thinking of that from the beginning. I feel that that's something he added later and just kind of put where he saw fit.
Very easily could be the case, though. I do like the idea Sue becomes a scapegoat for all this, because in truth, when bad things happen, and this is one of those things that, again, King can do very well, is find truth in society through these twisted stories. And one of the truths that he digs at here is that when bad things happen, people like to find something or someone to blame. And
yes,
Sue becomes that person, largely because everyone else is dead.
Touche.
And that's something that happens. You need to have, if possible, a living scapegoat for this. People have an attachment to that, and they feel more confident and secure when they know they have someone to blame. And you can't blame Carrie, because she's dead. You can't blame her mother, because she's dead. But Sue survived and is still tied to this. Or at least they feel she's tied to it. So that's where all of that comes about. You know, briefly touch on why the book made for a strong film. Because De Palma's version of the movie focuses entirely on the Carrie plot without any of the framing devices that King uses, it's such a short story that it's easier to adapt that to a film without cutting out major chunks or having to add in a bunch of extra stuff, because it's not necessary. That a core story of what Carrie is condensed to a point where it's a short runtime for a movie, just as it's kind of a short runtime for a read. So those two things lined up very well. Yeah, again, we'll get more into that as we discuss the film. But overall, yeah, it's quite a light read, but you still get believe me, these characters leave an impact in that short time.
Right, and as we keep saying, King is all about characters, and that's obviously what this story is about. It is about the characters, and the supernatural is just a vehicle in which to explore them. And it is a quick read, and it's not just because it's shorter, but because it is engrossing. Also, I think because there are no real chapter breaks, you kind of just keep going to each new paragraph. That's how I was thinking, basically. Oh, I'll just read one more paragraph, and another paragraph, and another paragraph. It felt like you were just eating, you know, reading little chunks, like you were eating, you know, another chip from a bag. So I finished it within 2 days, which was a lot faster than Salem's Lot and The Shining, which are longer, but did take a solid week for me to get through. It is a quick read, and I think it's a pretty engrossing read. And like always, it's about the characters, and you have pretty complex feelings about a lot of these characters. And I think more so than Salem and The Shining for me. I mean, The Shining, I think we talked about how I'm glad I read it now, because as an adult, I can really understand a lot more of what's going on from a psychological level, about feeling like you're a failure or trying to provide for your family, you know, or a relationship that is broken, but you're trying to fix it. But this story here, this one really does bring me back to those days of middle school and early high school, that kind of taunting and bullying. And it was pretty rough to read in places. King does a very good job really describing just how painful it is to be an outsider at school, and how people really dehumanize you when they do that. They just kind of treat you as punching bag of the school, and nobody really thinks of you as a person. And then later, as you said, Sue gets kind of turned into a scapegoat for all this. So it's an interesting book about basically how people treat other people, and how a lot of times they just treat people poorly and think nothing of it. and think that there'll be no consequences for it, that this is just the way things are, and I can just treat someone like a piece of garbage if I want, and that's my right as a person. As we'll find out, they will come to regret that terribly.
Jeez, do they ever regret it? For a full disclosure here about how I approach the readings of these books when we go through them, is that I have the book, and I have the audiobook, in order to make life a bit easier for me. When I'm doing something that requires me to be able to, or requires me to use my hands, eyes to look at something else, I have the audiobook going so I can ingest the story. And then when I have the time to read, I switch back to the book because I prefer reading as opposed to an audiobook. When I approach this, the audiobook starts off with an introduction from King, in which she discusses the fact that Carrie as a character came from an amalgamation of two girls that he knew back in school, both of whom passed away. They were both awkward and had kind of their own struggles. One of them, in particular, came from a very religious family, and King remembers seeing this cross in their living room, this huge cross above the couch, and he remembers thinking to himself, if that thing ever unbolted from the wall, it was big enough to crush somebody. And it just struck him, that imagery of a cross that large sitting in the household. Another girl, painfully shy and awkward and bullied, and King regrets the fact that he was too young, as young people are, you know, just inherently kind of foolish and stupid. He was at that point where he didn't step up. He says he didn't participate, nor did he try to stop it. It's something that you can look back on and regret, and as it, you know, comes out, one of the girls committed suicide later in life, and another one died from complications from epilepsy. And he felt that the ghosts of these girls, in a sense, were crying out to him to become the character of Carrie. So she's based off of real-life incidents and people that he's seen in his life. And reading or hearing that makes us all the more kind of difficult to see play out, especially when you combine that with myself having been bullied a bit in school and seeing people be bullied and knowing how cruel kids can be. Yeah, it is an incredibly difficult read to get through at times because King doesn't pull any punches with how bad the social antagonizing can be. And it's scary that in today's day and age, when we're discussing the concept of bullying more openly now and how devastating it is, you still have people who will say things like, oh, kids today just need to suck it up. I mean, kids were bullied back in my day and they got through it. It's like, really? Did they get through it? Did they really get through it, or did they end up developing psychological problems that weren't diagnosed back then, or did they end up becoming drug addicts and alcoholics later in life, and this was the reason why that all happened?
Yeah, I mean, you see that all the time, people saying, you know, kids should just suck it up, and I was bullied and whatnot. But, you know, it's usually from people who weren't usually bullied and usually didn't have those issues, so it's very easy for them to act like it's not a big deal, but it is a big deal. And when you're a kid, school is the world, and you can't really see beyond it. You can't really fully grasp yet what life's going to be like after. You kind of just live in the now when you're in school. And if you're being bullied, it's terrible. Something that always bothers me too about these events is when extreme things do happen, like when someone takes their life, which happened at the college we went to. I remember some kid who did come from a very religious family and was dealing with this homosexuality, ended up jumping out of the towers and dying. And I remember that he was someone that was very alone, people thought was really weird, kind of picked on. And after he died, all this outpouring of support and love came out, I remember. And if you just needed someone to talk to, you could have come to me. And I just, that kind of stuff makes me so mad because people don't do that when someone needs them. It's only after they do an extreme act like that, that people all of a sudden pay attention and think, oh, maybe we should have done something. Yeah, maybe you should have.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that all too often now with the school shootings and whatnot, about how maybe if we just talked to him, it's like, well, you had the opportunity to for years and you didn't. And now this person has done an extreme act and that's made you take notice. And it's really sad that it took to that moment to get there. But I think you see the hypocrisy from so many people after an act like this happens. Yeah, it's hard to read about. And the thing about Carrie is that the supernatural is used to almost buffer some of the horror before it, because I think a lot of the most horrific parts of the book come before the prom, when she's being thrown, you know, when she's in the shower and they're throwing all the tampons at her, or the abuse she takes from her mother who locks her in the closet. I mean, so much of this stuff is just awful and yet happens across this country every day. You see that, you see kids getting bullied, you see parents that abuse their kids, and in a way the horror at the end is like a release of that horror, the earlier horror. It's a horror that you can almost take solace in compared to the horror that you experienced during the first part of the book.
It's kind of scary too how you have to put this into modern day parallels. There's people who celebrate school shooters. Like, there's people who who almost borderline level worship the Columbine shooters. And there's fan clubs online and things like that who, you know, they speak out, yeah, those kids had it coming, that they killed, and they should have done that. And in a way, when we cheer for Carrie, or some people who cheer for her and getting her revenge, it's kind of the same thing in a sense, but again, that paranormal element to it changes the context. It's disturbing how when we see things from a different perspective, it changes our value system. That should affect the way we try to view things if we're trying to be empathetic as people and try to look at the world from that perspective. Like I said, if you change your perception, it can change your value system. And that's a big thing to think about.
I mean, it's a book with no easy answers.
Right.
I think that's what it really comes down to. I mean, who do you really feel most sympathetic for? I think in the end, you probably feel most sympathetic towards Sue in a lot of ways. But even she took part in Carrie's shaming at the beginning of the book and kind of does things out of guilt for that in order to make herself feel better. It's a hard book to wrap your head around because the kids and the people in Carrie's life are so terrible to her. They either treat her like garbage or they abuse her or they just act like she doesn't even exist. Or like in the case of the principal, can't even get her name right.
Right.
You know, that's how invisible she is to everybody. And yet the act that she does at the end is so horrific that you're, like you said, if we had just changed out telekinetic powers for a school shooting, we would look at her as a monster. And we would think that she was the villain of the piece. None of these kids deserved it, even though all these kids ever did was treat her like garbage. So again, who do you feel sympathy for? Who's the victim in all this? Yeah, it's complicated, but I think that's what makes it a good read, but one that it does take a lot of soul searching to figure out how you feel about this story and how you feel about the different characters. And like you said, kind of stepping outside yourself and your value system. And I think all too often in today's society, people don't know how to step into other people's shoes. That's something that I've really come to understand the older I get. There are some people who can, but I think a majority of people just don't understand that people are different from them and don't live the same life as them. It's hard for them to empathize. I just realized that there's such a lack of empathy. And I think that's a major theme of the book, is that there's just a complete lack of empathy from people about this character. And, you know, in the end, just doing little things sometimes goes a long way with people. Just a nice, you know, small act of kindness, which is what Sue tried to do. But then at the same time, it almost feels like no good act goes unpunished, because what Sue does is what, you know, sets off the supernatural horror at the end that just causes more pain and destruction everywhere. It's a heavy book. I mean, despite how short it is, it does give me more moral ramifications than, say, Salem's Lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, even though Salem's Lot does deal with some terrible stuff like the punching of a baby, but at the same time, we also know that's wrong and they get kind of what's coming to them. And there were people in the book that we could fully get behind in Salem's Lot that we didn't have a lot of moral quandaries about, whether it was Ben Mears or Mark, you know, or the school teacher. There was different shades of characters, I think, in Salem's Lot, where there was good characters, bad characters, and people in between. In this book, every character has different shades themselves. I think that's the big difference. So with Salem's Lot, you knew who the bad people were and who the good people were. Here, everyone's good and bad in different shades. So that's what makes it really kind of uncomfortable as a reader as you're going through it.
Yeah. However, we do spend more time with these individual characters in a way that we didn't with Salem's Lot, where we were bouncing around an awful lot. There are a couple who are more unambiguously terrible. And I guess we'll start off by discussing some of these. And on the subject of unambiguously terrible, the start of that would have to be, if there is an antagonist, debatably there's a couple that you could say. But one of them, most surely, is Carrie's mother, Margaret. This is a woman who, she found God, and then she must have lost her way somewhere along the lines and found another God that she calls God, and she went off the deep end. When Elton John sings Jesus Freaks out on the streets, this woman's beyond those. She's so far gone, it's incredible. But at the same time, she's not so far gone that we don't see people like her in real life, and that's really the terrifying part about this all.
Yeah, what's terrifying about her character, too, is that she has been completely warped by religion in a way that is so unhealthy and really not Christian at all. It's interesting how it's fighting. She is against what's natural. Having sex is natural when you're a married couple, and repopulating and being a woman. And she fights against these things at every step. She never wanted to sleep with her husband. She never wanted Carrie to have her period. She never wanted to develop breasts. So all I could think of is like, so basically you want the human population to all die. You don't believe in repopulation, period.
Yeah, that's how twisted she is.
We want to see the whole world die eventually because no one can have sex. And again, the abuse she puts Carrie through, shoving her into a closet all the time. I mean, that's the thing about the story. What happens at the prom is horrific and maybe could have been avoided if Sue hadn't had Carrie go to the prom with Tommy. And yet I think Carrie's story still would have ended tragically either way. The way Margaret treats her, it would be very easy to leave her locked in there. I mean, they talk about how she's locked in there almost all day to the point where she has to go to the bathroom in there. She doesn't get fed. She doesn't drink. If she had been left in there long enough, she could easily die of starvation or just, you know, the isolation of it. It could be very easy for her to die. And then once that happens, you know, Margaret gets sent to prison for the rest of her life. It is a book where there's so many horrors happening before supernatural horror. The supernatural horror almost feels like, I said, a release. It's almost easier to accept than the other horrors that were happening in the book and what probably would have transpired without it anyway. There would have been less dead people, but there still would have been tragedy.
It's hard to say that she's a tragic figure. Her life growing up was not strong. As we find out more about her, her father was killed and her mother remarried. And she saw that as a very sinful relationship. And she was probably, you know, pushed into this fundamentalist Christian view by the tragedies in her life. And you also see this too, again, in real life, where a lot of people who turn to religion, become fanatical about it, are people who have had terrible things happen to them in their life. And they rely on religion as a crutch to get through instead of like a guideline for their life or for, you know, a philosophy about why we exist, things like that. But Margaret has used it as a crutch to prop up her entire life. And it's become so much a part of her that she's twisted it into her own malevolent interpretations at times. She obviously did not have a very good relationship with her husband, which probably only furthered things. As a matter of fact, even her conception, the conception of Carrie, was done in kind of a very odd, it's not an easy section to get through, but she was raped by her husband because it was not consensual, and that begot Carrie, and then her husband died, and regardless of how strong or weak their relationship was, that obviously unhinged Margaret even more. And then having this child that I don't even realize if she knew she was pregnant. I think she thought she was basically a tumor.
Right. I mean, that's an interesting thing. Is not only does Carrie not understand what a period is, but her mom didn't understand what pregnancy was. And again, I think that shows such a ignorance and using religion as everything to the point where they don't even understand basic science, basic biology, basic human chemistry.
Right.
I mean, it's so appalling just how ignorant that mom is and how much she shoves that ignorance onto Carrie as well, and at the same time demonizing themselves. I mean, there's a lot of self-hatred in this book. This woman hates herself, and she's put that upon Carrie as well. And it's hard to read, but as you said, it happens more often than we like to think.
Maybe not to the, well, actually, even then, to the extreme of refusing to have a baby in a hospital and accept any medical help. Like, you do have people from different religious sects who believe that any kind of medicine is against God. And that's the extent that we have Margaret here, because she didn't even know what pregnancy was. And then when she did have Carrie, there were screams that the neighbors heard so loud that they called for help just to send somebody over there. And the police find her covered in blood with a knife from the kitchen that had been used to cut the umbilical cord. And there's Margaret holding her baby. After that, the police and pretty much everybody out in her neighborhood just want nothing to do with this crazy bitch. Just nothing at all. You know, this is sad, too. This is what's really sad. Because even though Margaret gets progressively worse towards Carrie as Carrie is trying to act out and maintain a sense of, like, normalcy in her life, Margaret's getting worse and worse. But even at the end, after Margaret is killed, she has consumed Carrie's life so much with everything that it's all that Carrie knows. So even after she kills her mom, she realizes that she's killed off, like, one of the biggest parts of her life. That's why when Carrie's dying, she keeps calling out for her mother, because she doesn't know anything else besides her mom. Right. She knows that her mom is bad, but the devil you know is better than the devil you don't.
I mean, the cycle of abuse is so etched in her that she doesn't know how to live life without it.
Right.
And live life without her mom. It's all she's known. I think we talked about this a little bit a couple years ago, too, with DC Comics, with Darkseid, and how they wanted to free the people on Apocalypse.
Yep, in Superman, the animated series.
Right. And it happens also in the Superman comics, too. I had just read it, actually, this year, the issue where that happens, where Superman wants to free a lot of them, but they don't know how to live, and they actually like Darkseid, and they are okay that he kills some of them because they deserve it at times. It's the only life they know.
Right. As Darkseid says in the cartoon version of it, "I am many things, Kal-El, but here I am God."
Right.
And that's essentially the same thing that we have with Margaret here, is that as abusive and manipulative and restrictive and overpowering as she is, she's also the only world that Carrie has ever known. And Carrie kills it. Kills that world by killing her mother. And so even in her death, as she's just lying there about to die, all Carrie can do is cry out for her mother, because that's all she knows. And that is... that's horrific in its own way.
I know people who have had really bad relationships with their parents or one of their parents, and yet they can't, even if they need to cut them out of their lives or they need to put more boundaries up with their parents as they get older, they can't, because it's their parents. You know, you want your parents to love you, and you want them to basically show you basic human decency. You know, you have the idea that Carrie is frustrated with her mom, obviously, but she never hated her mom. You know, she was just confused and angry and lost, and was hoping that her mom would give her more love than I think she was capable of.
Yeah.
It's a tough read. I think that's just something I'm going to keep coming back to over and over again, is that despite how short it is and how quickly you can read it compared to The Shining, I find it in some ways the toughest of the first three books to get through on an emotional level.
To switch from her to Carrie herself, you know, here's a girl who, as we find out very quickly, doesn't even know what a period is. And when she has it, she feels like she's going to die. She thinks she's bleeding to death. That kind of ignorance, not willful ignorance, it's just kind of forced on her by her life, and naivety and innocence is our introduction to Carrie, and really does a good job of setting up just how pitiable, I don't want to say pitiful, but pitiable, this poor girl is. And I like the fact that a lot of this is kind of seen, in a way, through the eyes of the gym teacher to start, since we have an interesting thing with Miss Desjardins. Initially, when she sees Carrie like this, can't understand what the fuck is wrong with this girl. She is just angry as all hell that she's acting like this, until she realizes, oh my god, this isn't an act or anything. This girl, this is a poor girl who has no idea what's happening to her. And being able to see it from her perspective helps illuminate what a kind of a situation that Carrie is in. Because we have a character in story who's like, oh my god, what the hell has happened to this girl that she's so isolated and all this stuff has happened. It's terrible.
Yeah, and I think if there's a person that seems like a genuinely good person besides Sue, it is that gym teacher in this story. Even though she admits that seeing Carrie act like that almost brought out the worst in her too, because it was just so frustrating to see somebody that ignorant. Kind of how she puts it when she's talking to the principal later about the incident, that, you know, she kind of almost understands why they turned against Carrie, even if it was a really terrible thing to do.
You know, Carrie does not carry all of her mother's traits. She recognizes that, thanks to being in the school system, that some of what she's experiencing is not normal. And this happens more, we see this happen as Carrie almost kind of rebels against her mother. Eventually, flat out, does rebel. She's been learning more about how life is supposed to be because of the other girls in the school. She's unable to detach from where she is for obvious reasons, so she can't embrace that new life that she could have if she was a part of that world, so to say. Very much a social outcast. King goes out to describe how mismanaged her skincare is and things like that, which, given the fact that her mother is insane and she spends most of her time in a closet, you know, makes sense. It's just, again, sad to see this girl in this state, because she's painted out to be a perfectly kind and considerate person, but she's just a target for everything wrong with school bullying today and, you know, decades ago.
Yeah, I agree with that. So I guess we should talk about Chris, who might be the other antagonist villain of the piece after her mother. Let's not lie. We've all gone to school with a girl like Chris.
Yes, we have.
We all know who the queen bee is, and we all know that she is a bitch. I won't name names, but I knew plenty of Chris's in my life going to school. Treated people like garbage, treated me like garbage, and thought nothing of it. And it also, something that I really like, because it wasn't in the 1976 movie, though it isn't one of the adaptations, is the scene where Chris's father comes in to try to get the school gym teacher fired.
Yes.
Because his little daughter's so perfect. We had that all the time at the high school I went to. I mean, I did go to a high school where there was a lot of white, rich, privileged children that could get away with murder because their parents would allow it. And I loved that scene. I love the way the principal didn't back down on it. Well, if you're going to go to court over abuse and verbal, you know, assault, then we're going to countersue with what your daughter did, because she's not only has done this to Carrie, she's done this to multiple people. And we all have it right here in our record. So good luck. But at the same time, because they don't go to court, it almost felt like Chris would get away with it in the end anyway, because she's privileged and she's pretty. And so life's just handed to her on a silver platter.
Right. And I want to point out one thing that I think is important here, too, is that because the principal stands up for Carrie, here's a guy who does not even get Carrie's name right.
Right, and, Kathy.
he just can't wrap his head around it. He still is trying to do the right thing for her and standing up for her. I'm glad that kind of a character is in here, because you do have people who are well-intentioned, even if they're not 100% like either in your camp or aware of what's going on. But he represents kind of the everyman here, who, not fully exposed to it, doesn't fully understand, but he's trying to do right. He's just not fully committed to the fact that this girl could use a hand. Like, really need some outreach to help. But he's one of those people who's, again, like you mentioned, when people say, oh, he could have done more, he's exactly one of those people. He could have done more, but he's not a bad person by any means. He's doing right by Carrie, but he just doesn't realize he needs to be doing more. And it would be to the detriment of this novel if this principal just, you know, completely backed down. Because then you have that unrealistic thing of like, oh my god, everyone except maybe this one person or two people are pro-Carrie. Everybody else just, no, the entire world hates her except for these two people. No, the principal serves as a stand-in here, showing that there are good people in the world who just are too detached or don't attach themselves to a situation where a person's in need like they should.
Kids who go through that, they get bullied, but they're not bullied necessarily by every single person in their life. It's just that they're bullied by enough people and the rest of the people in their life just don't take a stand or say anything about it.
Right.
So that's what makes it feel like the whole world's turned against you. It's really just that a couple people have targeted you and everybody else has chosen to just turn their back and ignore it. or not, like you said, not do enough or step in or, you know, do the right thing.
Of course, incidentally, as it's, you've alluded to earlier, all, no good deed goes unpunished. And if he right. hadn't stood up to this lawyer and allowed all this to happen, you know, Chris would have not been in detention. She would have gone to the prom. Carrie wouldn't have killed an entire town. You know, what ripple effect, basically, is what I'm saying.
That's the thing. What he does, what Sue does, the nice things that they do for Carrie all end up leading to that moment at the prom. Like you said, it's a ripple effect. It also, like I said, makes you feel more complicated about some of the actions that the characters make, because those good deeds lead to really bad consequences. It would have been better that they didn't invite her to the prom. They didn't suspend Chris.
And speaking of bad consequences, we also see where Chris is in a very bad relationship with a person who's also like a, you know, fellow psychopath or right. sociopath, Billy. This kid is fucking terrible news.
Yeah, but I think it also shows the cycle of abuse.
Yeah.
Since some people act the way they do is because they're also being abused as well in a different way. And so she's in an abusive relationship with her boyfriend, and she is taking it out on other people in her own way. And that happens a lot, all the time in school. A lot of people who do that is because they're dealing with their own demons and their own abuses in their life that you just can't see.
What's disturbing about this, too, is that Chris, they describe Chris's past. She's the kind of person who has intentionally manipulated men in previous relationships, using sex to get what she wants, or manipulating them with the promise of sex. And she meets Billy, and Billy is a fucking rapist as well, by the way.
Yeah.
If Chris is bad to level of like an 8 or a 9, Billy's a 10. And he's found this person who they basically have like a codependent relationship with each other, in the sense that Billy has no qualms about bringing harm to this girl and pushing her out of his life if necessary. They seem to work better as kind of like this malignant couple, and so they're together. But it's really messed up the relationship that they have and the way Chris views herself and views this relationship.
Yeah, just like everything in this story, the character relationships are complicated. And so even though Chris, in a lot of ways, is one of the story's biggest villains, she's also a victim as well in her own way. Yeah, and Billy, we all knew Billy too.
Yes, we all did.
We've all met Billy. Unfortunately, most of us are just lucky to not get to know them too well. Yeah, so I mean, that's that. And then I guess now's the right time to talk about Sue and Tommy at this point.
Tommy, otherwise known as Buckethead.
Nice. Well, go on. I'll let you start with Buckethead.
All right, well, I mean, first of all, who the fuck is killed by a bucket? Of all things.
Well, I don't think he died of the bucket. I think he was just knocked unconscious, and then he died in the gym. That is the idea that I got, that he was just knocked unconscious. And as somebody who has dealt with concussions in my life, I would not be surprised if Tommy was somebody who had had multiple concussions up till that point due to how much sports he played. I think it's mentioned that he did a lot of, he was a jock and he did most of the sports. And of course, we, you know, between football and soccer and whatnot, we've learned just how easy it is to get multiple concussions by, you know, slamming into people, bouncing the soccer ball off your head. It's something that in a lot of ways we're still learning so much about. And, you know, I don't want to get on too big of a digression, but in a lot of ways, that's the most horrific moment for me of the book, is when the bucket hits his head, because it just brings back like past trauma with my concussion. I don't believe that the bucket killed him. I just believe that it gave him a concussion and that he was just left to burn alive in the gym that Carrie sets on fire, and that nobody could really help him. I think some people tried, and then chaos just ensued, and they couldn't do anything.
I would hope that's the case. I mean, stranger things have happened with freak accidents, but I would prefer not to think that death from a bucket hitting his head was the ultimate cause there.
I think they mentioned something about him still breathing or something. I mean, I could be wrong, but
I don't recall. And
because they do jump ahead that scene with someone else telling it, and then they go back to the present again.
Yes.
So it shifts perspectives and jumps ahead and jumps back during the whole prom scene. So it's actually a little harder to wrap your head around initially while you're reading it, unlike the movie.
Even in the movie, I mean, he's out for the count, it seems.
Oh, yeah. But what I'm saying is, I'm very much under the impression that he just got a concussion, that the bucket didn't kill him, being burned alive in the gym did.
Either way, we've discovered that the true moral behind Carrie is actually about chronic traumatic encephalitis. But
okay.
It's all about CTE, and we just didn't know it yet. If there's one person who does represent kind of like the true good of the book, who's not in any way kind of a bad guy, with like the least shade of gray to him, it's Tommy.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And the only thing that's kind of questionable, I guess you could say, is that he does mention in the internal dialogue or monologue that he's very confused and conflicted about his feelings. Like, he mentions how he loves Sue, but he's falling in love with Carrie, and he loves the both of them at that moment. So it seems like he's very lost in emotion, but maybe that could also be some sort of psychological effect that Carrie is having on him with her powers. We do find out that Carrie is able to create psychological imprints on people's minds.
Which is interesting, because that's not really explored in the movie.
No.
So that was interesting to see in the book that not only does she have telekinetic powers, but she kind of has the powers of persuasion, maybe? But persuasion that she's not even fully aware of.
Right.
At the same time.
Yeah.
So that is interesting that it's starting to dive a little deeper into just how capable and powerful Carrie is.
And it's hinted at there with Tommy in this kind of lost in emotional confusion that he's in. But overall, I mean, he goes to the prom for the sake of Sue with Carrie. But it goes to show how much he respects Sue's decision and decision-making. That he's like, okay, for her, I'll do this. But he doesn't just half-ass it. He goes all in with being there for Carrie and doing right by her. And I really appreciate that about him. He doesn't, you know, lie to her blatantly by saying, oh, you know, I'm doing this because I love you. But he kind of skirts the truth enough at the same time being truthful. Yes, I'm dating Sue, but she doesn't want to go to prom, and I want to go with you. And he's not lying when he says that. He's not telling the entire truth, but he's not lying. And I respect the fact that he goes and does everything he can to make this a memorable time for her. He, you know, gets the door of the car for her, pulls out and then pushes in her chair for her, all these very gentlemanly things. And so if there's anybody in this book who's just like the pure good, it's Tommy, which sucks even more that he gets killed by a bucket.
Well, you know, concussion and then die and then burned alive. It's a two-step process.
Either way, it's still the bucket was instrumental to his death.
It sure was. But again, I can completely understand, because if you've suffered concussions before, it doesn't take a big hit to have dire consequences.
No,
sometimes
it's true.
It doesn't even. Sometimes just one hit in the right place can do real damage. So I'm not going to hold that against him. Like I said, I don't think it killed him. I just think it knocked him out. But, you know, talking about Tommy and Carrie at the prom before the bucket, King does such a good job of those scenes really making Carrie much more likable and having her come out of her shell. And just some of the moments she has with Tommy are just so sweet that it's just so sad what happens. But I like the scene where they're going to vote for the king and queen, and she just says, you know, I don't really know who to vote for. They're not really my crowd. You know, I don't even have a crowd. But she says it in a very kind of joking, giggly manner in a way. And mm-hmm. It's funny how, yeah, when we demonize people like that so much and we treat them like garbage, we think that they're not capable of other human attributes. But when we get to know them, we realize, oh, they're actually a really funny, interesting person that, you know, I never really looked at that way before. King does really good job showing her just who she could be if people did treat her with a little bit of decency and respect.
And apparently Don McLean was hot at the time?
I guess Don McLean was hot at the time. I know. Well, I mean, it's the 70s, you know. Just as we said, somehow David Soul or whatever was a hot heartthrob, you know, at that time with Starsky and Hutch. I don't see it, but I guess other people did. Yeah, I mean, that song was huge. People loved it back in the 70s. My mom had it, so.
Yeah, but this is also like 8 years after that song, so.
Yeah, but it's only, what, 2 or 3 years after the book was published?
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, in their mind, you know, Don McLean probably had a thriving career for the rest of the 70s.
That's true, yes.
which he obviously didn't, unlike, say, James Taylor, who did.
Right.
So, you know, I can't fault it on that. He's basically making a prediction that just didn't happen.
You even beat Dexius Midnight Runners. Don't worry, honey. You haven't heard the last of them.
Right. Or on the opposite side, the moonlighting episode, just give us the numbers. Just give us Madonna's number. No one's going to want it in a year.
Yeah. But anyway, the reference to the fact that Carrie makes, like Doug was saying, Carrie's coming out of her shell, and she even makes a joke about how Don McLean would fancy her or something to that extent. It kind of, like, stuns some of the people there, showing that, oh, Jesus, Carrie's got a barbed wit. Who would have thought?
Right.
But it is fun watching her emerge and see this person who she could have been if it weren't for the factors of her upbringing.
And that's the other thing, too, is that maybe the mom was right in a way that the devil was working in her, but really, it's her constant abuse and fear that actually sets all this off. She basically brings about her own demise, as far as I'm concerned, the mother.
Yes.
She's the one that's so afraid of it happening, she makes it happen.
Yeah, self-fulfilling prophecy, really.
Exactly. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. She only saw evil in Carrie from the beginning just because she saw sex as something evil and something she didn't understand, and she wanted to kill Carrie multiple times because that's the Christian thing to do, is to kill babies and children.
Well, yeah, that's how we do that. And unless our babies are able to summon asteroids, in which case, obviously, at that point in time, it's like, nope, we're good.
But anyway, back to the prom.
Yes. What are your thoughts on Tommy and Sue?
Theirs is a relationship that I think is the platonic ideal in a lot of ways, unlike Chris's relationship with Billy, which is the cycle of abuse and, like you said, codependency and malignant. Theirs is a relationship that you feel is very natural, that they care about each other. They're the couple that you could see that kept dating through college, eventually got married. You know, they feel like that classic high school couple that, if given the chance and if Carrie hadn't burned down the school gym, would have been together for the rest of their lives. The fact that she's able to ask Tommy to take Carrie to the prom actually shows a level of trust and commitment that they have with one another, that there wouldn't be jealousy over that, that he would take another girl to the prom, that she and he love each other so completely that they're not afraid of what would happen by taking some other girl, that there's no jealousy, that, you know, et cetera. And again, Tommy does start feeling some feelings for Carrie, but from what the book is conveying, it feels like that's Carrie's telekinesis kind of manipulating him more than what he's actually feeling. But the idea that he actually genuinely wants to make sure she has a good time is there. So he is a gentleman, you know, and a scholar, apparently.
Yes.
Apparently he does very well in school as well. I think that they have a very good relationship. That's one of the tragedies of the story, is that by doing this nice thing for her, it ruins their relationship because he dies.
That is something that will ruin a relationship pretty quick.
Yeah, pretty quickly, you know, bucket to the head. King does a good job portraying them as a really likable couple, and that you believe that they don't mean Carrie any harm.
Yeah, and then Sue herself. Again, we don't get an awful lot about Sue in depth until near the end, when we get to see her being questioned in front of the committee and when she's describing passages out of her book. And she's trying to quickly remind people that Carrie is not just this figure to be researched now, that she was an actual human being with feelings and emotions, who had been wronged, and who she felt guilty about mocking. All this stuff kind of comes together later on to flesh her out. So at the time that all this is going on with the prom and her trying to eventually figure out, you know, what's going on after the school explodes, and she just doesn't seem fully utilized as a character for much of the story until the end. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, because Sue is not instrumental to the plot outside of the pushing Tommy to her. But I should say her personality and character outside of her forgiveness is not very instrumental. We don't need to spend a lot of time with Sue to find out what she's doing to move things along. But because we have this added depth of what's going on after the fact, I feel like maybe we should have spent more time with her and gotten to know her a little bit more maybe a couple more scenes between her and Tommy, or something a bit deeper with them that could have helped. Because I don't feel like we get a good grasp of Sue in depth.
Again, you have to wonder how much of this is stuff that he put in after. I mean, this is a book that it does feel like he struggled to write and felt like he went back and changed certain things and added certain things to it.
Right.
So again, maybe some of the stuff with Sue, it'd be interesting to see if he had written this book a couple years later, how different it might have been compared to his other stories, as he got more confident as a writer and also fleshed out his characters more and just wrote books that were much, much longer than Carrie was. We get enough of her that we understand who she is, where she comes from, and I don't feel like she's necessarily underwritten. I think we could have seen a little bit more from her, but again, it's not really her story either.
Right.
It's not like Salem's Lot, where it's all these different characters we're spending time with, that the town itself is the character here. Carrie is the main character, and everyone around the story is basically coming in and out of Carrie's orbit.
Right. She's not like Ann Norton in Salem's Lot, where the character should have been developed more before being killed off. Here we have the case of, yeah, she's not as instrumental as Ann was to Salem's Lot, but something more would have been nice, but it's not instrumental to making sure that this story works. And it does work.
Agreed. It does work. And, you know, having only read the movie, it was interesting to see the prom scenes, how certain things were different. Carrie runs away first and then comes back, but she does it from all the outside of the prom, which from a logistical standpoint kind of makes more sense that she wouldn't be inside where the carnage is happening. She'd be right outside of it.
Right.
So that she wouldn't get hurt. But again, it also makes sense that the movie didn't do that because it's more visceral to have her there in it. Whereas the book, it's fine. But then she doesn't stop at the prom. Now she's all riled up. She's not coming back down now just because she's taken down the prom. Then she walks through town and starts destroying the town. So that was really interesting because I had no idea that that was coming. That not only was she going to take out the prom, she was going to, she kills her mom, and then in the movie, that's where she dies, but not in the book. She keeps going. She kills the mom, and then she just more chaos and destruction and explosions. But it fits in that King is having this be a full-blown attack that the world has to deal with. That it's not something that can be justified or, you know, talked away. It happened, and it happened on a huge scale that a whole town experienced. It is interesting to hear some of the other townspeople's testimonies about what they saw that night, from the guy who was in the drunk tank to the older woman and her friend who ran out into the streets. It definitely gives it a more visceral feel, I think, that you're getting it from different people's perspectives as to the chaos and carnage that was unfolding after she leaves the prom. And it's obvious at that point that any shred of decency that Carrie had left was destroyed from that incident.
It's kind of hard to know at that point in time, too, how much of this is Carrie purposely being vindictive, and how much of it is a result of her powers waging uncontrollably. Is she, like, fully consciously doing this stuff? Or is this just a manifestation of her powers going rampant? Either way, she's cutting a swath of destruction from the prom to her mother's house. And a lot of people get caught up in the events of it. Not all of it is fully intentional, either. Like, some of the things that Carrie did just had these little ripple effects, like the fact that the gas mains got busted and then some guy happens to toss a cigarette out and it just ignites this full force of the gas. And the same thing kind of in the school, where the sprinkler system and then the wires, it doesn't seem like Carrie was putting two and two fully together, that, hey, I can use the sprinklers to ruin all their dresses and they'll be just like me. And then the thing about, oh my gosh, the guy's, he's dancing from touching the microphone stand. I should push this person in the amp. She doesn't seem to be fully connecting, and it's probably because she's in such a tortured psychological state. She doesn't seem to be fully connecting the ramifications of her actions at that moment. But that just goes, again, to show how far gone she is. She's in kind of a disassociative state. Not fully there, but her powers are. Powers are goddamn fully there. And they are raging havoc on everything. A lot of people die from electrocution. A lot die from just the force of the explosions that happen, because there's gas stations that blow up too. But shit goes down, and in pretty quick order. One of the things that I found most effective was, like, one of the points of view ones that you mentioned from, like, the older lady who's trying to, like, meet up with her neighbor and guide her out of there, but the neighbor gets scared, runs off, and electrocuted. So this poor woman is trying to stand perfectly still until Carrie moves away, and then she's trying to step over and take big steps over the live wires. All the while, she knows who Carrie is without even knowing who Carrie is.
Which goes back to there's more going on than just telekinesis. There's some kind of mind thing happening as well, where she's influencing people's thoughts and getting inside their head. But Carrie's path of destruction destroys the town. That's what's interesting, because that's not really touched upon in the movies so much. That what Carrie does kills the town, much like Salem's Lot. I mean, it's different because Salem's Lot, everyone gets turned to a vampire. But here, as they said, even after the destruction's over, I mean, the town as they knew it is dead. There's a whole generation of kids who are gone. Lots of the manufacturing and industry has been destroyed in the town. And a lot of people are just getting up and leaving. And it's the death of a small town, basically, what through Carrie's actions. You get the idea, and I think we'll be seeing this more and more. King is very much attracted to small town life, especially small town New England life, but also seeing small town New England life be destroyed. Because we saw in Salem's Lot, we see it here, and I know we're going to see it again. But I think that's also what makes it more real world, is that we really do see the consequences of Carrie's actions afterward, that we see that this destroyed a town, this destroyed people's lives. Even the people who aren't killed, this destroyed their life, whether they lost someone they knew, or they lost their job, or they lost their house, whatever it may be. It end of this town as they knew it. She destroyed this town, and now all that's left is for all the scientists and writers and everyone else to try to figure out why she did this and become a case study.
It's kind of a morbid comparison, but I remember you telling me something about, because you used to live in Rhode Island.
Yes.
And back in 2003, there was a terrible fire at the Station nightclub that killed 100 people. And I remember you saying that because Rhode Island is such a small state, it seemed like everybody there either knew somebody who died in the fire or knew somebody who died in the fire. It was a very kind of close-knit, massive tragedy that was magnified by the fact that when it's such a small area, the impact of it is so much more profound on the people who are around that area. You know, that wasn't something that's going to turn the station fire wasn't something that was going to turn everything into a ghost town. But similarly, the impact of it and the fact that everybody felt it is huge, and it's kind of exactly what King is portraying here with what happened in this small town. It's just that the scale was bigger, but something like that devastates emotionally and physically a community.
Oh, yeah, and it's something that has long-term ramifications, too. You know, talk a little bit more about the station fire. You know, like I said, everyone kind of knew someone that was involved in it. Years later, when I was in college and I was interning at a radio station, one of the tasks they gave me that they didn't want to do themselves is I had to go to basically an abandoned radio station building with some other guy and go through all the documents and look at all the times that the station, the nightclub itself, advertised through Clear Channel and mark them, because they were still having the trial about it. Yeah, even though I didn't know anyone in it, it still affected me in a way. The fact that years later I had to, on an internship, I had to search through documents in an abandoned radio station, which I don't know if that was the best place to put a college intern at. Okay. But I went through all those paperwork, and yeah, it's something that just lingered for years and years in that state. It was a tragedy. Yeah, everyone kind of almost knows everyone else to an extent in Rhode Island, because it is the smallest state in the country. Yeah, it was a tragedy. That's actually a really good point. I hadn't thought about that until you brought it up, station fire incident. But yeah, that's a good comparison to it. But as you said, here it's on a much larger scale, because it's not just one building burning down. She took out half the town.
A lot of things that King describes that escalate the situation about how Carrie's power blew up the fire hydrant, so they couldn't even get access to the water to be able to put out some of these fires. All those, like, little things added up to make this so much more catastrophic. the way the fire was spreading from the school. It just these terrible situations, and not to mention the down power lines and the complications that makes so that people can't communicate and they don't have access to electricity. It's amazing how devastating those things can be. Yeah, she gets to her mother's house and kills her mom in a pretty grotesque way. In a way, it's creepier than what we see in the film. Margaret's heart is stopped by Carrie just psychically stopping her heart.
Yeah, yeah. And the difference in the book, too, is that Carrie went back to that house with the intention of killing her mom.
Yes.
Which is not in the movie.
Right.
This is the point where our sympathy for Carrie really becomes clouded, because she goes home with the intention of killing her mom and has almost no regrets. As I said, at the end, she doesn't know life without her mom, so then maybe she starts to regret it, but that was cold malice right there. She walked in the door and was ready to kill her mom and did it in a way that was not self-defense like the movie. The movie, it comes across as self-defense.
Right.
And so it makes Carrie a little bit more sympathetic in the end than she is here.
Yeah, this is just flat-out matricide. The way it's described, too, that coldness, is like it's when she says it's easier when you can see it. It's just kind of creepy how she puts it and what she does. She goes out in a pretty quick way after that. In the movie, we see her impaling her mother with different utensils through the... But the idea of stopping her heart, it's a gradual process. We see Carrie, or at least we read how Carrie's doing it slowly, slowly, slowly until it comes to a stop. And then giving her mother darkness like she felt that she always wanted. Like, I'm giving you what you always wanted, Mama. That's how far gone Carrie is. And then, yeah, like you said, she regrets it afterwards pretty quickly. But it's too late by that point in time to do anything about it. And then somehow, you know, still wounded now because her mother did successfully stab her pretty good. She makes her way out and she's trying to get to the building, the roadhouse, where her mother has confessed that she was conceived. And here comes the comeuppance that... If we felt bad for Carrie, this puts us a little bit back in her favor, because here comes Chris and Billy in the car, and Billy wants to run the bitch over. Carrie ain't gonna have any of that shit. Takes the car and is able to cause it to crash into the building, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty satisfying. I mean, you wanted to see Chris and Billy die, and they get their own special final death compared to a lot of the other characters who all died in the gym or in the ensuing chaos afterward. As the reader, we definitely wanted to see them get their comeuppance, but after that, that's kind of the end for Carrie. She has taken her revenge on everyone who directly impacted her life, and now she really has no more reason for living anymore, which is, I think, why she dies quickly thereafter. It's not just the mortal wound. I think she's lost the will to live at that juncture.
That, and it's heavily hinted at that her powers took a toll on her body. It's mentioned before how it can be very draining. And here she's used her powers to a massive extent, to the level of which she probably burnt out her body from the inside out, so to say. It's not like the movie Matilda, where Mara Wilson's character of Matilda can just use the powers all willy-nilly. Hey, get the book over here. Put the chalk up there. Interestingly enough, in the book Matilda, after Matilda does her grand stand to kind of show up the Trunchbull and end things, her powers fade away. It's like her powers were based off of the abuse and the harassment that she had suffered. And once they were purged from her body, the powers were gone. Similar situation here with Carrie. She's used up everything she had, but it came at the cost of her body. And now she's got nothing left except to try to analyze Sue when Sue comes around.
That's a good point, too. Yeah. And of course, Matilda has more than its fair share of similarities to Carrie, even though one's meant for adults and one's meant for kids.
Yeah, Matilda's kind of like, you know, the alternate universe story of Carrie. The same girl, basically, but slightly different upbringing. Similar results, though.
Right. Well, you know, the difference is that her mom was a religious nut in Carrie, where in Matilda, it's just that their parents are very ignorant and lazy and stupid, and she's not.
Right.
It's a little bit more about intellectualism, Matilda, where I think Carrie's a little bit more about emotionalism or whatever.
Yeah. These two would have gotten along well, though.
That kind of brings us to the end of the book, other than... And we already discussed the death of the town. I mean, that's what the last section of the book is. It's a mini section called The Wreckage, where we learn about how badly damaged the town is to the point where it will never really recover. Other than that, of course, we also get the little cliffhanger at the end where, there's another girl who's been born with telekinetic powers. it's probably Matilda.
Probably is.
Because it's the late 80s, and that's when that book came out. So it's a setup for Matilda. Take it away, Roald Dahl.
We do also find out, too, that poor Sue has had some sort of a psychological trauma imprinted upon her from what Carrie was doing trying to read her mind at the end. Carrie implanted in her all the horrors that she had experienced and put those into Sue's mind, along with the idea of Carrie was transmitting her death to her. So Sue now has to carry around that emotional baggage, which is some pretty heavy shit.
Yeah, that is some pretty heavy to have to carry all that around.
The scars run deep for a lot of the people who were in Carrie's life, fled to death or to just a complete change of what their life had been. So the impact of her power and of her story, it just changed everybody around her. In a similar way, reading the story is very profound, too, and has an impact. So it's art imitating life.
Pretty much covered the book. They said it's not a long read, but it's a good read, but it's a difficult read on an emotional level. Like I said, there's good people, but in a lot of ways, they're the ones that set off some of the worst things that happened in the book. And the terrible people, in their own way, suffered their own abuses and issues. It's a book that is filled with a lot of shades of gray, a lot of complexities, and not a lot of easy answers. In a lot of ways, sadly, is more relevant now than I think it even was in the 70s.
And so if there's a message to take away from this, it's that you don't necessarily have to be friends with everybody, but if you see abuse, you know, recognize what that could be doing to somebody, and stop it. Put a stop to it. Take that stand. I said, you don't have to befriend the person, but you can let them know that there are people who are going to fight for them and stand up for them, and that things can get better.
Right. Just showing simple acts of kindness. Just smiling at somebody. Just asking somebody how their day was. Just little things that don't take a lot of effort, but for some reason, people just can't seem to do all that often a lot of the time. That goes a long way for some people. It means more to people than I think some people realize. Just doing small acts of kindness to others, that can really make somebody's day. For Carrie, she just didn't have any of that her whole life. Just simple acts of kindness just eluded her.
Yeah, so that's the story of Carrie, and we'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the book. So please leave them here on the channel. The CastBox FM has a comment section, as well as YouTube, where this is also uploaded. And you can tweet to Critical Android, or you can email thecriticalandroid@gmail.com. And yeah, I can share your thoughts as well here with Dougie as we continue on this journey to the Carrie films.
Well, all I'll just say is that some of it's great, some of it not so great.
Yeah, so join us as we carry on these wayward sons.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Do a Supernatural montage.
Do love that song.
Oh, yes, they do.
But no, thank you very much for being here, Dougie.
Well, it was a pleasure as always. And I, you know, like I said, we're 3 for 3 in terms of King. They've all been great so far. So from what people say, it's only going to go up from here. So I can't wait to talk about the next couple novels.
We'll see what unfolds before us. But we have some movies to get through first. And we'll treat you to those discussions.
Let's just say that we're going to watch some of these movies so you don't have to.
That's the way of putting it. But yeah, go ahead, find a copy of Carrie, track it down, read it. You'll definitely be engaged by it, and it should have an impact on you, as we discussed. And that's what good literature and good horror, specifically, is supposed to do. It's supposed to leave an impact, and it does. For myself, the Critical Android, and Dougie Style, thank you very much for listening as we advise you all to stay out of Maine.